Welcome to another edition of El Paso Primetime. I'm Dennis Wu, joined by co-host Noemi Rojas. Welcome.
Thank you, Dennis. Today, I bring you Dr. Richard McCollum. He is a professor of medicine and founding chair and director of gastroenterology research at Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center, Paul L. Foster School of Medicine here in El Paso. I'm very excited to share the story of Dr. McCollum with our listeners. He is not only a gastroenterologist, he is a researcher, and he is an innovator. Welcome, Dr. McCollum.
Naomi, thanks very much. Dennis, good to be here.
Tell us where you're from. You have a wonderful accent.
I'm from Australia, Brisbane, Australia, on the East Coast.
And did you grow up there?
Grew up there. Grew up in a medical family. My father was a doctor. My mother was a nurse. Only son, pretty traditional stuff. Went into medicine. Went to medical school there and left at age 25, 26 to explore postgraduate training over here in the United States and see what I could learn and grow into. And unlike most Australians, I did not make it back.
Do you keep up with footy?
I keep up with footy. We got that rugby union and rugby league and cricket. That's a way of life. But no, I didn't quite make it back, but I certainly go back a lot. But it was a opportunity here to pursue some wonderful training and meet some interesting people and get involved with some academic programs, and I was excited to stay.
Well, Dr. McCollum, I lived in Kansas City, Missouri. I was a reporter there for the Kansas City Star. You also worked in Kansas City on the Kansas side at the University of Kansas at their medical school. And can you tell us where else you worked in the United States and how you came to El Paso?
Well, I did my residency in two places. I first arrived at Louisiana State University in New Orleans for a year. Went to Washington University Barnes Hospital in St. Louis, where I met my wife as well, a St. Louis girl. Did my GI fellowship training, which is sort of your core training after residency, at UCLA, Los Angeles. Stayed on there on the faculty for three more years. Then was fortunate enough to go to Yale University and really sort of learn about the inner circle of academic medicine in this country at the Ivy Leagues in New Haven for 9 years. Then I thought I was ready to become a chairman, so I went off to become chief of gastroenterology at the University of Virginia in Charlottesville, Thomas Jefferson country, University of Virginia. Spent 11 years there and then came to University of Kansas, became a Jayhawk, and spent 12 years as a Jayhawk. And then running a division of gastroenterology and a center for GI research. And I thought at that point in my career I was ready to look at a more global picture, perhaps help direct the Department of Medicine, help young faculty, be a mentor, be a guide, sort of have a vision to develop a great department. And joined in the search for a new founding chairman at Texas Tech University here. Paul L. Foster School of Medicine was just being envisioned and started, and they wanted a founding chairman to come down and sort of give them some blueprint of how universities have been run around the country in the past and employ those principles here in El Paso. So I was fortunate enough after a year or so of searching to be chosen as the founding chair in 2009 and arrived here to try to help grow and develop the school as it's developed now. We've graduating our second class of Paul L. Foster students, and many things are running well. Still a lot of work to do, but it's been a great ride, and I've been fortunate to be part of it.
So what year was it when you came to El Paso?
I came in January 2009.
What I think makes you special is that you are the creator of a gastric pacemaker.
That's correct.
Now, when people think of a pacemaker, they usually think of for the heart. What your pacemaker does is it stimulates the stomach muscles for people whose stomachs have stopped working. Tell me, how did you become this inventor? I mean, how did that come up? How did that happen?
Well, out of frustration, Naomi, we had patients coming to us in my latter years at Yale and then in the beginning at Virginia where we really had no options. The nausea and vomiting was relentless in many ways. All we could do is operate and put a tube in the intestine so they could feed into the intestine and bypass the stomach. But as we saw the stomach sitting there in front of us at surgery, we said, you know, there must be something creative we could do. We have cardiologists putting electrodes in the heart. There's got to be ways to reactivate muscle and stimulate it. So we consulted our biomedical engineers, and we developed some guidelines as a team to let's start putting electrodes in the muscle wall of the stomach and trying to stimulate it with different programs, different degrees of amperage and voltage. And so over time, we developed those principles. And then a commercial company, Medtronic, developed a different stimulator called a neurostimulator. It sends a electrical message into the stomach, but it's not contracting muscle. It's sending a nausea message, an anti-nausea message to the brain. Our stimulator that we developed contracts the stomach muscle and makes it want to squeeze tighter. Ours is not commercially yet developed. We have a patent. We have a company. The Medtronic company developed another variety or another type of stimulator called a neurostimulator, and that's available today in this country, and we put them in every month. We're also continuing our research on this, what we think is the final solution, the true gastric stimulator type of electronic message. So it's been a massive growth in electrophysiology of the gut. We're sort of the cardiologists of the gut. You can measure electrical signals. Your stomach has electrical signals, just like your heart. And the goal is to synchronize those electrical signals to maximize the strength of your stomach.
And from what I understand, people come from all over the world to be treated by you. This condition is called gastroparesis, where your stomach no longer is working. How common is that in the region and in El Paso?
Well, we quote a figure, Naomi, of around 5 to 6% of the country as a top figure. So we're talking probably 10 to 15 million gastroparetics in the country. So you could do those maths for a city the size of El Paso. And suffice to say, it's not an infrequent problem, particularly in diabetes, which is the showcase, if you like. It is the major entity which slowly erodes and decreases your nerve function over time, over years, among other organs that unfortunately are picked on. The stomach is one. And probably a half of our patients or a third of our patients to a half are diabetics, either so-called type 1 insulin dependent more than type 2, but so many type 2s in the world that we see both varieties of diabetes that present with nausea, inability to finish a meal, feeling full quickly, feeling uncomfortable when they eat, and eventually even having to vomit some hours after a meal. These are the kind of symptoms that would alert you to the possibility that your stomach is failing.
And you are NIH, National Institutes of Health, funded
Yes.
by the millions of dollars.
Right.
And so you are always looking for patients to participate in your studies.
Exactly.
For the people who are listening, what kind of patients are you looking for your studies?
We are NIH-funded, as you stated. We're one of 8 centers in the country that are called the Gastroparesis Consortium. It's kind of a club made up of top universities around the country. We're fortunate to be one of those. And so our charge from the NIH is to develop a database, develop a cohort or a group of patients who have gastroparesis, paralyzed stomachs, follow them meticulously over the next 5 to 10 years, learn all about them from their genetics to their tissue samples to what happened to their stomach, give them exposure to the best medications we can find, and try to have a partnership. We learn from them, and hopefully we can give them the best care at the same time. This has been a very productive relationship. We were funded for 5 years. Now we've just been refunded for another 5 years, and we hope to go on. So we have 600 patients throughout the country, a number of those here in El Paso, who are the database. And we meticulously study everything from their nervous system to the tissue samples from their stomach to their genetics to how they respond to medications. Some go on to get gastric stimulators. Some go on to need surgery and need feeding tubes to help maintain their nutrition. So the patients that we look for are ones that say, you know, when I eat a meal, I'm prematurely full. I'm satiated, what's called early satiety. I can't finish a regular-sized meal. I'm full. I'm uncomfortable. I'm bloated. I'm nauseated. And later on, I may have to even vomit. I may have some heartburn at the same time. They're the dominant symptoms that make you think, you know, many patients would say, maybe I've got an ulcer, maybe I've got indigestion. But after we sort it out, no, it's a slow stomach called gastroparesis.
Doctor, the discussion this afternoon obviously has been centered in on gastroparesis, but, you know, the media lately has accented other maladies, Crohn's disease, celiac disease. Are these tied in to gastroparesis, or is this something else?
No. Sprue, or sensitivity to a substance or a protein in the food called gluten. No, this is a dietary component which has become very topical. It's very topical in the public world and diagnosed through serology, taking samples from the blood or doing biopsies of the intestine, and you have to go on a special diet. Now, different world, it can present with bloating and gas and changes in bowel movements, diarrhea particularly, responding specifically to the gluten-free diet. And then the other entity you mentioned, Crohn's disease, again, inflammatory bowel disease, two categories, ulcerative colitis and Crohn's, again, very topical in lay literature and in the press. We're actually doing some major research on the fact that we believe that the cause of it, in many cases, is atypical mycobacterium or a tuberculosis bug that atypically develops in the gut, transmitted through animal contact and other sources. But no, those are different entities. Part of the world of GI, I see them,
okay,
but they're not in the world of gastroparesis. They could be mixed up with an area sometimes called irritable bowel syndrome, where you have ups and downs of abdominal pain, particularly after meals, often pain that radiates into the lower quadrants or the lower part of your abdomen, and sometimes looser stools, sometimes more constipated stooling. And some of those patients can have nausea and can feel that food activates all these symptoms, and they may be initially concerned that it's their stomach, but it turns out that it's actually the lower part of their bowel. And we call that irritable bowel syndrome. But sometimes these are difficult symptoms to differentiate until you have the opportunity to meet a patient and carry out a more concise and thorough history.
In case you're joining us today, we are speaking with Dr. Richard McCollum, gastroenterologist and researcher with the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine. Doctor, do we know what causes gastroparesis?
We are getting a grip on this now, Naomi, thanks to the Gastroparesis Consortium. Often our patients end up going to surgery to place the gastric stimulator or to place feeding tubes to maintain nutrition. We take that opportunity to biopsy the muscle of their stomach, and we're studying it under special staining conditions, and we're now learning that there are basic problems with cell structure. The cells that activate our electrical signal have been damaged. The neurons or the nerves that make the muscles contract, that release chemicals like acetylcholine, those nerves have been damaged or impaired. And we're now finding that if we can intervene earlier to preserve the nerves, stop the degeneration of these electrical signals, this will be a very important future. We actually, at Texas Tech here, have become a world leader through Dr. Offman, one of our endoscopic ultrasound specialists who works with me. He is able to now access the smooth muscle of the stomach without surgery. By putting this ultrasound probe in the stomach, guiding a biopsy forceps, we're now obtaining tissue without surgery. And this is going to advance our knowledge rapidly, so it's no longer predicting what it might be if we go to surgery. We can analyze this in the beginning and strategize your therapy and begin to focus on new therapies. So this is a very exciting time in gastroparesis. It's been sort of reacting to nausea and vomiting and giving our palliative drugs, palliating the patient. Now we have an opportunity to cure by actually intervening and blocking the problem, stopping the degeneration. So this is a very exciting time, and this is one of the benefits of a consortium which is funded and stable where you consistently, year after year, contribute and evolve a science. And this has been a very successful and exciting time for us.
So are people born and predisposed to have gastroparesis?
Well, females dominate. That's one interesting thing. 75% of the patient population here around the world are females. Whether the estrogen and the hormonal milieu of the GI tract of a female is more vulnerable, they certainly have more constipation, they're more prone to gallbladder disease, they dominate irritable bowel syndrome, they dominate gastroparesis. It's a very sensitive GI tract, shall we say. And whether it's a hormonal milieu or whether it's a serotonin variant that some people are also studying, that's one factor. Otherwise, there's a very small percentage of children who are born without nerve ganglia in their gut, congenital loss of ganglia. But otherwise, no. We can't predict which diabetics will develop a slow stomach versus their kidneys going into failure or their eyes failing more. We do know now that many of us develop what's called idiopathic gastroparesis. You look normal, and then a year or so from now, you come to me with nausea and vomiting and these other symptoms. What happened to me? Well, we now believe in retrospect that you had a gastroenteritis. You had a gastrointestinal infection, probably viral, called novovirus or rotavirus or Norwalk agent, Epstein-Barr virus. Most of us recover. Restaurant events, food poisoning, camping, traveling, we bounce back. A subset, a very virulent bug, a very receptive host, a big dose, damage to the nerves and muscles and to the electrical system. And it may take months, years to come back. And those patients are called idiopathic. That's a big group. We can't predict who they are, but we're now learning that we could intervene in those patients and shorten their careers very significantly.
The headlines that you made recently in my publication called Synapse was a study. It showed that antidepressant drugs do not improve symptoms of gastroparesis. Are doctors trying antidepressants as a treatment, and why?
Good question, and I'll try to shorten the story for you. So as I said, we try to palliate our patients. We give them drugs to stimulate their muscles, try to regenerate what's left and make them squeeze harder, and block nausea in the brain so you feel better and you function and go to work and appear to be kind of sort of in balance with your entity, with your gastroparesis. Some of our patients have a lot of pain. Even with eating small meals, they're extremely uncomfortable and pain tends to come into play. These drugs, they're called neuropathic drugs, otherwise called centrally acting agents. They ameliorate pain potentially by blocking the brain-gut connection. So the gut and the brain are intimately connected. Signals from the gut go to the brain. We interpret them as pain or nausea, etc. The feeling was if we could somehow modulate those neurons in the brain, maybe there'd be less traffic, less noise, and we wouldn't feel as much nausea or pain. So it became as a way of addressing the nerves going to the brain, not just the stomach nerves and the nausea center. And tricyclics, represented by nortriptyline, the drug we studied, are sort of the old classic model. Now we get into more fancy stuff, such as the Prozacs and the Cymbaltas and Remerons and so-called centrally acting serotonin agents that treat depression. We started with the more simplistic ones called the tricyclics, which are often used by our colleagues in practice to ameliorate irritable bowel syndrome, the pain and the sensitivity of the gut. This gets into gut sensitivity, eating, stretching, touching, very sensitive gut. Could we take care of that part of it by using a tricyclic antidepressant? The answer was it didn't separate itself significantly on a statistical level from placebo. However, in looking at the data in more detail, subsets of patients had their nausea helped or their pain helped. So not a negative study in as much as it was perhaps initially portrayed. We don't separate every symptom combined. The sum of the symptoms didn't separate. If we individually focus on each symptom, particularly pain and nausea, we could separate them by giving the patients tricyclic. So a subset of our patients may still respond to these agents, but they're not panaceas. They're not panaceas, and that's what we learned from this study.
So if there's somebody listening and they're thinking, you know, I have all these symptoms that Dr. McCollum is mentioning, I want to be part of his study, I want to contact him, how do they reach you? How do they find you?
All right. So, you know, I'm old school, Jeremy. I actually give out cell phone numbers. Can you believe that? Because I'm not sure I can actually give you one person that can sort of be all things to all people. So I try to be kind of the point guard. And I'll be glad to give folks on the call here my cell phone number. I give my patients my cell phone number. I think it's a worthy thing to do. Doctors are not just in the clinic available. We should be accessible, accountable, and reachable. So I'd be glad to give you my cell phone number. Call me anytime. I can then initiate the ball rolling, get you into my clinic, rather than have you inundate a clinic number and one of our secretaries or operators wonders what's happening. It would be much better to call me and maybe we could do a little brief discussion, then I could point you in the right direction. So if that's okay with you, I'll give you my number. We're still in Kansas, Naomi. 913, but the rest is 706-6746. 913-706-6746. Richard McCallum. Glad to call you back. It may be a little later in the afternoon or the evening. I'm a little busy during the day, but I will get back to you. And it'd be my pleasure to try to help. And we want to thank our patients in the greater El Paso area who have already been involved with our research. And we appreciate their willingness to be part of the future, helping the future of our medical system. A very worthy and a very appreciated contribution.
Are you the only doctor in town that treats gastroparesis?
Essentially, yes.
And doctors who treat gastroparesis are pretty much few and far between in the world, right?
They are. I mean, we gastroenterologists cover the broad waterfront of GI, but this is sort of a love or a real feeling that you want to focus in some areas. I'm called a GI motility doctor. I cover the nerves and the muscles, how we function from eating the food, passing it down our esophagus, going through our stomach, going into the small bowel, the large bowel, and having bowel movements. I cover the whole GI tract as a motility expert. So anywhere in that tract, that's what I do. My research has focused, lately at least, more on the gastroparesis world. But we do a lot of work on the broad spectrum of why do people have nausea and vomiting. Not all of it is gastroparesis. Irritable bowel syndrome, unexplained pain, diarrhea and constipation, trouble swallowing, heartburn, reflux. So we cover that broad front. Some of our GI colleagues do that in town, but I think most of them, to get special tests, we have the right technology, the equipment, the sophisticated testing that helps our colleagues take these patients to another level and gives us the right care. So we sort of are part of the team in town, but we're sort of the extra pathway. We're sort of the Mayo Clinic, where you come to us as a final court of appeal.
I think you're one of the doctors in town who are helping to lift El Paso and this region up in terms of allowing the region to become a major medical center. You usually hear about people going to Houston to receive treatment. Well, people are coming here now to find doctors like Dr. McCollum and many other doctors that we will interview on El Paso Primetime in the future.
It leads me, Doctor, to ask you, because it's such a young, relatively young study, worldwide, where is the most common occurrence of gastroparesis?
Hard to get handles on all this, as much as you do with diabetes, where you have a lot more sort of societies and organizations. I think worldwide, again, we quote 3-5% of the population of America. I don't know if you could extrapolate to every country. We're accused of being a bit obese and help, hence more type 2 diabetics.
Sure.
But it's there everywhere. And one aspect is that these are middle-aged to younger females who dominate that 75% female. You're in the prime of life, raising families and working, and you're struck down. This is a very debilitating, far-reaching impact on family life and economics. And so we see ramifications throughout society when you have this disease. But I'd say it's everywhere. I'd say it's a little more, if you like, focused in this country because of the NIH and because we have 320 million people to work with, as it were, we have a little more data on what is that percent. But it's a pretty consistent percent. If we quote Sprue, Sprue's thought to be, which you mentioned before, celiac disease, is approaching 1%. So if you want to put in perspective, hepatitis C is 1% or 2% of the country has hepatitis C. We're talking 5% or so have gastroparesis.
Does your study show anything at all about the possibility of stress aiding this?
A very good question again. The brain and gut, intimately connected. And sometimes that's where the antidepressant background came in our patients. These were women who were nauseated, intermittently vomiting. Upper GI endoscopies and standard CT scans, CAT scans were negative. You didn't respond to acid-blocking drugs. What do you have? Maybe you're depressed. Maybe it's stress. Let's put you on an antidepressant anyway. So that's actually where some of this started. And what we understand now is that, yes, stress does particularly provoke symptoms in irritable bowel syndrome. It makes the gut a little more sensitive, a little more likely to have ups and downs of stooling and diarrhea. And stress can make you a little nauseated, as in the locker room pre-game nerves, which can make you nauseated or vomit, or before exams, we have diarrhea. Stress and the gut are intimate. But many people are falsely accused of being somewhat depressed because they haven't had a diagnosis made. They're looked upon as being of unknown origin. They're sort of falling between the cracks. And in desperation, sometimes antidepressants are started. I actually call nausea, for those of us who remember Rodney Dangerfield, the comedian, his favorite saying is, "I get no respect." Well, nausea gets no respect. It's a debilitating symptom which is overwhelming and is never really approached properly. So we see a lot of people that have been sort of lost and not really appreciated or cared for, and sometimes they're given the sort of aura that it must be stress causing all your symptoms. No, it's not. There are real issues in most of these patients. Stress can certainly superimpose and make it a little more muddy. The waters are muddier, but there's a real pathophysiologic entity underneath this.
Dr. McCollum, thank you so much for coming to talk to us. We've run out of time. There's a lot more to talk about, but we're going to have to say goodbye now. You have been listening to Dr. Richard McCollum, gastroenterologist, researcher, professor of medicine, founding chair and director of gastroenterology research in the internal medicine department at the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine. Give your phone number one last time before we go.
Thank you. I want to thank Naomi and Dennis again. This is a wonderful opportunity, and I'm glad to be in El Paso to help develop this great medical school. My cell phone number is 913-706-6746. Glad to help you, and look forward to hearing from you as needed. Thank you again for this opportunity.
El Paso Primetime is a production of KTEP. Past episodes of El Paso Primetime may be found on the KTEP.org website. Just click on Listen and then look for the El Paso Primetime archive section. We want to thank Dr. Richard McCollum for stopping by. His cell number is 913-706-6746. And we'll await you next Saturday for another edition of El Paso Primetime.